It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome to Money for Lunch, man. It's great to have you here. And, you know, getting a lot of great feedback on my latest, greatest deal here. And that is, what are we doing? Oh, the quote of the day. The quote of the day. So what is the quote of the day? Oh, hey. The quote of the day is, "You were created to succeed," by Bert Martinez. So, yeah, you were created to succeed. However, in order to succeed, yeah, got to put some things in the works there. You have to have a clear vision, right? You have to have a clear vision. You also have to have this crazy, ridiculous self-belief. It's paramount. You know what? I just got through spending a couple of days with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Randy Couture, Boss Rutten, and Ronda Rousey, right? And the thing that these guys had in common was this ridiculous level of self-belief, delusional level of self-belief. And that's kind of what it takes. Look, the other day I was talking to Brant Pandemic. No, it's – anyway, I'm going to kill his last name. Brant TV – he's produced and directed TV shows. He's been in several movies. Pavendick. Thank you. Pavendick. And we were talking about how do you handle fear or doubt or rejection. And he says you have to be delusional about it, because if you don't, it can completely destroy your business or your motivation or your drive, right? All right, today on the show we have Eric Wright. Eric Wright is the president of publishing at SCB Marketing. An innovative leader, dynamic speaker, and published author, he has taught leadership and management seminars on 4 continents, served on various economic development and visioning councils, and authored hundreds of articles, 3 books. Parcel and Wright's new book, Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars, Your GPS in the Era of Hyperchange. Eric Wright, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Well, it's good to be with you. And I enjoyed just listening to you for a moment and what you were saying about, you know, audacious confidence. And you're so right. You know, there's these characteristics that we see in all successful people, but particularly successful entrepreneurs. And you have just highlighted one of them that you know, overarching confidence, you know, no matter what the obstacles are, you know, we're going to prevail. We're going to do this. You know, we'll find a way. So that's great,
yeah,
that you identified that point. And you're right. It is characteristic. We do see it across the board, you know.
Yeah. You know what? And it's amazing to me, Eric, that I find to be really one of the biggest drivers this crazy, like, delusional, audacious self-belief. And that's really what it really takes, because you look at some of these things that people have done, and if it wasn't for the fact that they were somewhat crazy, obsessed, whatever word you want to use, it wouldn't have happened. I mean, you look at Elon Musk with his rockets in his electric cars. That's crazy. Who
Jeff Bezos the same way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You know, we and I know that you have seen this, but here's another observation: is that so often people misinterpret that. They say, oh, this guy's really cocky. This guy's really arrogant.
Yeah.
But that's not it. It's maybe they have an overdeveloped sense of self-belief. Or maybe they have realized, look, if I don't believe in myself, nobody else is going to. And so they just have it and they exude it. And those who are – it's funny. Those who are like-minded, they feed off that. Those who, you know, struggle with that probably internally themselves, well, they're going to struggle with that in others, you know. And but yet, nevertheless, you see it there. And it's really a mistake, I think, to assume that it's arrogance, to assume it's, you know, egotism or something like that. Because if you drill down with these people, and I'm sure you have found it, even with the people that you talked about, quite honestly, usually they're pretty humble people. They're pretty approachable.
Yes.
You ask them a question, and they'll give you an honest answer. You ask them about their struggles. You ask them about the obstacles they had to overcome. One question that I love to ask successful entrepreneurs is, what's the best lesson you ever learned from a mistake? And boom, you know, they're right out there with it. and so, you know, it's like you got to get over yourself in order to learn from those sort of people. Yeah. You know?
Absolutely. And what's interesting, kind of back to what you were hinting about or talking about, is that when you get around these people and you start talking about, quote, your crazy idea, they don't neg you out. You know, these people
right.
have gone through the impossible. They've already been told by everybody in the world that they could, that their idea couldn't be done. And they are usually pretty positive. They're at least going to encourage you to follow your dream. And I think that kind of what you were talking about, these like-minded people, you know, they feed off each other because it's
yes.
important. It's kind of nice to have.
Well, and as you have observed, it's not just entrepreneurs. You talk about a successful actor. You talk about a successful director. You talk about a successful software designer. They all have gone through that. And I don't think that they just have an overdeveloped risk tolerance. It's like they have learned that the only success comes as a result of persevering. You know, you're gonna fall down, but you're gonna get back up again. I'm not gonna accomplish anything unless, as Theodore Roosevelt said, you know, I'm one of those who are out in the arena, you know, who has blood on my face, you know. And you see that common denominator. And just last week, I saw that incredible film, Darkest Hour, and here's Churchill. And about the only person who believed in Churchill was Churchill. And the only person who believed in an outcome that was so audacious was Churchill. And when I left the theater, I looked at my wife and I said, if Churchill had not been Churchill, the world we know it would not be what it is today. But, you know, there's another example of that kind of personality. And I'm sure, golly, you know, I've read enough about the guy that I know he grated on some people and he had a sharp cutting wit that was just like a razor. But nevertheless, because he saw something that not only could be but should be and was willing to sacrifice his own political career on that altar, hey, you know, we enjoy the world we live in today. And without people like that, you know, things don't change.
Absolutely. You know, I've had the when you were describing Churchill, it also reminded me of Steve Jobs. And
yeah.
I've had the pleasure of interviewing several people who worked directly and reported directly to Steve Jobs. And everything you just said about Churchill could be applied to Steve Jobs. He was kind of a jerk to work for. He was hard on people. You know, but all of these people have both the good and the bad stories to tell, you know, they can tell you. I spoke to this one young lady. She said, you know, the first time Steve fired me, it crushed me. You know, by the third time he fired me, I was getting better. You know, and so she says that by the time I left Apple, Steve had fired me like, I think she said close to 10 times. And then she says, I don't think I have ever produced consistently better work than when I was working for Steve Jobs, because he just demanded it and demanded it and expected it and believed that you could do it, and you just lived up to it.
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing, and I've often thought about this. When I was an undergraduate, I was an art major. And so all during school, you were having to crank out these assignments in design and composition and blah, 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 blah. You just did it. Then you got to summer where you had a break and you say, oh, I can do whatever I want to do. And then I would always look at the volume of what I produced in the summer when I didn't have that pressure and that accountability and those deadlines versus what I did during the course of the school year. And I go, you know, this pressure is a very good thing. this deadline is a very good thing. And the fact that we all have people in our lives that help us, you know, recognize that and to develop that sort of internal sense of not only exploration, but of urgency to do things. Hey, that's what keeps us all moving. And I think you're exactly right about, you know, Steve Jobs. People ask me sometimes, he said, you know, how do you outpace your competitors? You know, we use this term barking dogs, you know, the ones barking at our heels. And I often tell him, I say, look, Steve Jobs didn't watch his competitors. Steve Jobs always played to where the puck was going. He was thinking about what the next thing was and how he could do what everybody said was impossible, you know, from a PC to digital animation to these handheld devices that are now a part of our life. I mean, he saw it, and he was always shooting to where he wanted to go. And that was one of the things, as you said, always made him great. And he forced other people to think the same way. You know, which that's never uncomfortable, but hey, we all need it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So let's talk about this. Your book called
Yes.
Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars. You co-wrote this with Jeff Pearsall. Is that right? Pearsall?
Right. Right.
And so I got to ask you, you guys are like hanging out and one of you guys looks to the other and says, hey, I got this idea for this book. Let's call it Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars. So tell us how this first of all, tell us how the book came about and how the title came about.
Okay.
Because that's a very interesting title.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the book came about because – you know, one of our businesses is a publishing business where we publish business journals. And so I in particular spend a lot of my time hanging out with and talking to and trying to glean insights from the entrepreneurial business leaders, you know, in our distribution, you know, geographic distribution based. You know, what I found is that whether it's some startup or whether it's a CEO of a major corporation, they all sort of have – they wouldn't be there if they didn't have an entrepreneurial gene operating in them. And
right. And
what Jeff and I did, we began to say, what are the common denominators in these type of leaders? What are the things that are a part of who they are? Just like what you mentioned, you know, when I tuned into the show, and what are the things that they're able to inculcate into the culture of their company that inspires both the people that are working with them and the people who are clients who are coming to them for creative solutions and creative answers. And basically, you know, over time, we began to see 10 common denominators. We began to see 10 different traits that these individuals embodied. And quite frankly, one of those traits, which, you know, we've already been talking about, is this idea, if you're doing things, if you are trailblazing, you're going to have people that say, you know, you're never going to make it. I mean, like
right.
the ad agency that told Marilyn Monroe, you know, she ought to find a new career outside of modeling, or told Elvis Presley, you know, he didn't have a future, you know, at the Grand Ole Opry. You know, I mean, you're going to face those things. They're the barking dogs, and you've got to decide, am I going to stay focused on where I want to be and where I want to go, and what do I need to have inside me to maintain that focus through thick and thin, or am I going to turn my attention to the dogs that are barking at my heels, because they're always going to be barking at your heels? And so that's sort of where we came up with that. And honestly, in the introduction to the book, there's a story about Jeff when he was about 11 years old and, you know, roaming the streets of the small town that he grew up in with his buddies on a bike. And there was this big dog that guarded this one street, and he decided that he was going to, you know, outrun the dog. And so, you know, he took off down the street, and the dog started chasing him. And right when he thought, hey, I beat the dog, he turned around, you know, to smirk at the dog, and the dog jumped up and bit him right on the butt, you know? And so that's sort of our opening story, you know, is hey, you know, you can pay attention to the barking dogs, or you can stay focused on the vision and the purpose that you have. And to do that, as we said, there are these common characteristics that we saw in entrepreneurs, regardless of what the business was, regardless of what the size of the business was, and things that they never outgrew. I mean, we recognize that we're living in this culture where the pace of change is greater than we've ever seen in human history. You know, and the thing is, once you think you've got the norm, the means, you know, things begin to change again. It's like that John Mayer song about daughters, where he describes his girlfriend, where she's like a maze, where the walls keep changing. And I think a lot of business leaders feel that way. You know, hey, I'm in this game, and it seems like right as I get my GPS calibrated, you know, there's another download I need in order to keep going. So what you have to do is you got to identify those things that don't change. You know, that this is my constitution. This is how I'm going to aid my decision-making process, because I have this core set of values. I have these compasses that are always pointing in a particular direction, which will answer for me whether, hey, this is a constitutional move or this is an unconstitutional move. And if it's unconstitutional for me, then I don't have to debate it. You know, I don't have to wrestle with it. It's like the decision is made for me, boom, and I can go on with the next thing. And I think we all need those sort of things, and that's what we're trying to give to the entrepreneur, you know, whether they're 20-something or they're 60-something, whether they're in a big corporation or whether they're running, you know, a startup out of their spare bedroom. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, it makes total sense. And I like the idea, because, you know, if you replace it, I guess, dogs with critics and bark with criticize, right? You know, critics don't criticize, you know, I guess, people who aren't doing anything, right? People who are parked.
Exactly.
They're only going to criticize, you know, yeah, they're only going to, the dogs are only going to be barking at you when you're moving. So I like that. I love that. More than ever, that is it. Now, let's talk about this, because in our world today, majority of the people don't want to be barked at, right? They're afraid to be criticized. They're afraid to be barked at. So let's talk about the mindset. What have you found out? What new mindset must today's leader have to address the onslaught of criticism and changes in the workplace?
Well, first of all, we live in this age where everybody has a platform, and that's the internet.
Yes.
And anybody can get on there, and anybody can say whatever they want. That, you know, there's great freedom in that, and there are great, you know, benefits to that, but golly, there's some incredible liabilities to it as well. And what you have to do is you have to believe in who you are, and you have to believe in what you're doing, because unless you do, nobody is ever going to buy into it. You know, you're not going to gain a following, you know, promoting, you know, something that you yourself aren't convinced of. Now, will that convince everybody? Will that cause the critics to be muted? No, it will not. But first and foremost, you got to say, hey, you know, come hell or high water, this is where I want to go. This is what I want to do. And then you just have to factor in, just like you have upturns and downturns in the economy. If I'm a real estate investor, if you don't go into that business with the foresight to say, hey, the economy is going to go up and my market's going to go up, the economy is going to go down, my market's going to go down, you're going to get broadsided. And if you don't go into whatever endeavor you're pursuing with the idea that everybody's not going to see it my way, and I might be able to learn something from their criticisms, from their observations, but I know what I know, and I believe what I believe, and this is the track that I'm headed to, and I'm going to stay the course. And I'm sure, like yourself, like everyone else I know who has ever made a difference doing anything, they have that sense of resilience and they have that sense of thick skin. You know, it's like the old saying, there's one sure way to never get criticized, and that's to do nothing. You know,
right?
And if your goal in life is to say, hey, I want to avoid criticism, easy, don't do anything. But if your goal is to accomplish something, I mean, we live on the Space Coast of Florida, where, you know, when you see, you know, 99% of the rockets being launched, you know, that's in our back door. You know, we can walk out of our office and we can, you know, see the vapor trail. When Elon Musk launched his Tesla into space, somebody came out and said, you know, if this guy has this kind of money to do a test flight that costs X number of hundreds of millions of dollars, that's a clear indicator that these guys are making too much money. That was this person's sole takeaway. This guy is privatizing something. He is untying a Gordian knot and I have been on top of the space program. I grew up here. My father worked out at Kennedy Space Center. I've seen it all my life. This guy is innovating something that was fossilized through a lack of innovation. And the only comment that this person could come up with is, wow, this is a clear indicator that these guys simply have too much money. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. That's like saying, you know, to go into a Carnegie library and say, wow, this is a clear indicator that this guy Carnegie had too much money because he built libraries all over the country. I mean, like, right. You know, so yeah, so you're not gonna avoid that. You know, those people are out there, and the only sense of purpose and sense of substantiation they have is as a critic, not as a doer. And you know, you just gotta swallow hard and realize that that's part of it, while at the same time not becoming deaf to, you know, all market factors or all critics, you know, so that you can learn.
Right.
Well,
no, absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And you know what's so funny you should say that, because we have in our little neighborhood, we have, a gentleman who is extremely successful. And at the same time, we have our street has had this pothole for a while. And one of my neighbors made the comment that our extremely successful neighbor should just go ahead and pay for it because his net worth is so much. And it's amazing to me, you know, how sometimes what woke me up is the guy who is saying this is also a very successful entrepreneur. He owns, he has like 150 people that work for him, but yet he sees himself as some kind of victim. I'm thinking, dude, where is that mindset coming? right? I mean, hey, this other guy should pay for it because he's got so much money. Well, dude, you got twice as much money as I do. I'm like, work it. Neighborhood. You know, I had to hawk everything just to get in. And so it just cracks me up how this this victim slash pity party slash critic type mindset seems to permeate everybody.
Yeah.
We got to catch ourselves from falling into that.
Well, it's almost like you need to be vaccinated because you're exposed to it so much. It's funny, Jeff, who's my co-author, we made a deal last year. We said, we're not going to watch network news for a month and see how we're doing, you know? And the reason was, is because, so much of it was just filled with this vehement criticism and fault finding that it was affecting us. It was affecting how we were approaching things. And we just said, that there's just the toxicity here that we gotta kind of insulate ourselves from. And I think I think one of the reasons that extremely wealthy people, tend to hang out with extremely wealthy people is for that very reason. It's not that I just like being around wealthy people. It's like, I don't like being second guessed, about just how I do life, and it can be in any number of factors. You see this, but you're absolutely right.
It's amazing. It's amazing. All right, so let's talk about this real quick. Because, the book, ladies and gentlemen, is Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars, available at Amazon or wherever good books are sold. And so give me your insight. Describe your observations about the divergent path leaders must choose when facing faith versus fear. Talk about this.
That's a very good question. In our book, we define them both the same way. What is fear? It's believing something that you can't see is going to happen to you. But what is faith? Faith is the same thing. It's believing something that you can't see. It's believing something out in the future is going to happen to you. The only difference between those two emotional reactions is one is positive, one is negative, And again, like you were talking about, when I first called in, those individuals who are successful in whatever arena they are in, I mean, literally yesterday, I sat down with a superintendent of schools, for all of Orange County, 24,000 employees. Now, we talked, and I could see the same thing in her. She has to go out there, approach every day with faith that there's something out there in the future that I'm moving towards and is positive. But my gosh, could she wake up every day, conversely, with fear? There's something out there in the future that's coming towards me, but it's a choice. It's a paradigm that I believe you have to put on every single day. It's something that is informed, by your belief system. It's in something that's informed definitely by your experiences. But we all have to take, the sum of our experiences and we have to do the forensics on those. We have to unpack those and say, hey, this will take me in this direction and this will take me in that direction. And I'm sure like yourself, we both met people who have been through experiences in life that I look on and I go, wow, how did they ever do that? How do they maintain that kind of attitude when they've, come back from a war and they're missing a limb? But you see how some embrace that and say, hey, this is not what I saw for myself. This is not what I wanted. This is not what I like. But I have choices to make. I have choices to make about how that's going to influence my future, how that's going to shape who I am as a person, how I'm going to react to other people. And am I going to react positively to other people, or am I going to react negatively to other people? And so again, that was one of those factors that we saw, is that in a very real sense, the successful leaders that we have engaged with, and is it true of every single one? There's always the exception. But what we found was that it's not the rule, it's the exception that people don't have that sort of perspective. It's like most of them have the perspective that if I can help you up, I want to help you up. You know, it's better for all of us if you succeed than it is for, you know, some of us if you fail. So I want to help you succeed. I want to pull you up. You know, I don't want to put you down. You know, and so again, that's just part of the makeup of the, you know, successful leader, the successful entrepreneur, especially. And we saw, you know, basically we defined 10 of them. You know, we started with the foundation of trust, that first of all, you have to trust yourself. Then you have to build a framework of trust where people trust you. They trust your character and they trust your competence, you know, because, you know, if I go to a surgeon, I want the guy to have character, but I also want him to have confidence, you know, if he's working on my eye, you know. So it's that balance between those two, that trust is built on character and it's built on competence. And when you have that, everything accelerates. If you trust me, then you can give me the assignment. And I said, hey, you know, I'm gonna have this done for you, and I'm gonna have it done for you in 10 days, and you can go out and focus on other things. You don't have to sit there and micromanage me. Why? Because you trust me. And the amazing thing about trust is it's transferable. You know, if I don't know a good attorney, I can call a guy and say, hey, look, I need a great contract attorney, and then they can say, hey, I got the guy for you. This fellow, this gal, she's absolutely brilliant in that. And I go into that relationship with confidence, not because of my own experience, but because of the experience of someone else. Their trust has been transferred over to me, and therefore the pace of my acceleration, it's like hitting the gas pedal, because I don't have to worry about it. I'm not anxious about it. I'm not second guessing what I've done, because it's built on this foundation of trust. And we look at trust as some, you know, value add, character quality, it's all of those things. But what we don't always see is that's what causes business to accelerate. It's easy. When I trust somebody, you know, the negotiation is simple. You tell me it's going to cost you this much to repair my car. I trust you. I believe you. Repair it, because I know you're competent and you're honest, and boom, we can move forward. You know, that's, you know, and so that's one of these 10 characteristics that we outline and that we unpack, that we say, hey, look, these have to be a part of who you are as a business leader, as a political leader, as a community leader, as a nonprofit leader. And then these are also things that you need to build into the culture of your organization, because if they're there, you know, people are going to be engaged. People are going to be creative, and they're going to be excited because they're winning. You know, you're making progress. You're pushing things in the right direction. You know, so and as I said, the way we came up with them. Go ahead.
No, I was going to.
Well, what I was going to say is the way we came up with them is by interviewing all these people and looking at, okay, what's the common denominators? Here they are.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. When you're doing all this stuff, all these interviews, and you're putting all the stuff together, were you surprised by any one thing? Was there something that stood out that maybe just you weren't expecting at all?
You know, I have to say yes. Let me say that. There were two things. One was we were surprised by how prevalent these common denominators were. And the reason for that is you hear about the failures, You know, you hear about the Enrons, you know, Bernie Madoff, you hear about these stories. You don't hear about the hundreds of thousands that are doing it right, you know, who care about their employees, who care about their clients, you know, who really want to deliver, you know, quality goods and services. You know, that doesn't necessarily make the news. In fact, really, that's what got Jeff and I started in the publication business with business, is we said, you know, the only news you hear about business is bad news. You know, at least that's the way it was around here. And we
sure.
really wanted to say, to tell the good news, you know, hey, these are people that you can emulate and follow. And these are people that have overcome obstacles. You know, the other thing that we found, and it wasn't, I won't say it's not 100% at all, you know, nothing is, but in 90% of the individuals we found, is that they had a faith metrics that provided them with both a set of core values and a reason to hope that was transformative to them. It was, that surprised me. And you know, again, I began to, you know, talk to different ones. I began to see this, you know, and it wasn't, you know, these are all evangelical Christians, or these are all Jewish or Mormon or whatever. But I began to identify that most of these people reached a point in their life where they said, you know, I've got to have something that guides my formation, you know, that's higher than me. And I've got to have something really that gives me a sense of hope and gives me a sense of strength and gives me a sense of purpose beyond, you know, just what, you know, I'm engaged in my life, in my business, in my work. That was a surprise. That finding that common denominator was a real surprise. And so, you know, how do you communicate that, A, and then how do you help people, you know, incorporate that, you know, into their own system? And that was a very interesting discovery. You know, that was like a vein of gold that we weren't looking for, but we found.
Excellent. Okay, so in the book, again, the book is called Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars, Your GPS in an Era of Hyper Change. And one of the things that you guys put together is these 10 defining qualities for effective leadership. And unfortunately, we won't have time to go through all of them. But give me like the top, you know, give me like the first five of the 10. Just kind of rattle them off real quick.
Sure. I mentioned the foundation of trust. That's huge. We talked about a relational priority. That, you know, we're not dealing with widgets or robots. We're dealing with people. And people can tell if you care about them as a person versus I want something that you can give to me. I mean, you know, somebody, you don't have to be Mensa Society. A kid with Down syndrome can sense that. And so developing that relational priority, where you begin to look at people as having value because they're people, not because of what they necessarily can immediately benefit you in. It changes how you approach people and how people approach you. You know, what carries on to that is that should motivate you to find out what motivates other people. You know, what makes a great coach is, you know, he doesn't take an Dominican Sue and try to make him into a Tom Brady. He looks at this guy and says, wow, you know, this guy could be, you know, the greatest, you know, defensive tackle, you know, that's ever played the game, because that's how he's made. You know, there's an old saying in architecture that form follows function, that you design the building around the function that the building's going to have. In people, it's just the opposite. Their function follows their form. And most of the time, that's just inherent. So as a leader, you know, your job, your task is to find out, you know, not only how they're made, but what is it that really motivates them, and what is it that keeps them passionate about what you're doing. Vision, a major component. When Walt Disney built Walt Disney World, which is only about, you know, 60 miles west of where I'm sitting right now, he built Cinderella's castle first. And that's what he said, build the castle first. That'll keep everybody focused on why we're here and what we're doing. Yeah. And because he understood this point of vision. So that was the first thing that they built and erected. Then everything sort of went out from there. Processes, you know, anybody who's in business understands that, you know, until you move your enterprise to defining processes and understanding there's a process to get to where you want, it's not an event, there aren't any elevators, but there are stairways that you can take to achieve what your dreams are if you can just persevere and if you can just find what those processes are and begin to implement them, you're going to make progress. You might not go as fast as you want to go, but you'll make major process progress in the long run. And that's what we're all shooting for. And I suppose the last key that I'd leave you with is just this point of courage. You know, C.S. Lewis said, courage is not one of the virtues. It's every virtue at the testing point. It doesn't matter what the virtue is. You know, it's going to manifest itself as courage when you need that virtue. If the virtue is honesty, guess what? It's going to take guts to be honest when it's easier to duck the question or to fudge the numbers or whatever. Doesn't matter what the virtue is. The catalyst to every single virtue or every single quality is courage, because at some point in time, you know, you're going to want to break and run. It's just our natural inclination. You know, it's the fight or flight instinct. You're going to want to fly rather than turning to fight. And what that turning is, it's courage. And so
I love that.
Without that virtue, you know, all the other ones, they're just lofty sentiments. You know, if I say that I believe in equality and here comes this opportunity for me to put, you know, my money, put up or shut up and I fold, you know, what does that say about me? If I say, hey, you know, I believe in treating women with dignity and I'm in a situation where, you know, some guy is saying crude remarks and I just keep silent, you know, where is that virtue that I feel that I have if I'm not willing to allow myself to courageously step up to the plate? And even what we talked about initially, risk. I mean, it's great to, you know, you know, I'm a theoretical risk taker. Well, that doesn't exist. You know, if you're going to be a successful leader, if you're going to be a successful entrepreneur, you got to be willing to take risk. And what is it that enables you to take those risks? Yeah, you've got to do your due diligence. You've got to ask the right questions. But eventually, you know, you've got to make a step in the direction that could cost you something. And that all Absolutely. Comes down to this principle of courage, you know. And so, right. You know, it's funny. You know, and even in there, I always remember, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, one guy wanted brains, you know, one guy wanted heart, you know, and what did the other guy want? He wanted the knife, you know. And it's true. Most of us, if I just had more brains, you know, if I just had more passion. But what we really need is just the courage to exercise what we got, you know. So anyway, don't mean to go on.
All right. So let me ask you this. I have what I like to call is the bonus round here at Money for Life.
Okay.
These are the real kind of the meat and potatoes, if you will, of Money for Lunch. So, speaking of courage, let's talk about this. How do you deal with fear? How did you, because there's got to be a point, here you are, you're writing your book, And I don't know if you and Jeff had this conversation, but maybe you had an internal conversation with yourself that, hey, we're going to put this book out there. It may flop. It may be rejected. Yeah. All that stuff that writers go through. So how do you deal with fear?
You know, again, excellent question. And, you know, one of the Greeks, they organized their armies around a duo. You know, there were two soldiers, and everything was built on, you know, that synergy between those two guys. Police departments do the same thing. They send, you know, their police officers out, you know, in pairs and things like that. Because one of the best ways to overcome fear is to have somebody else there with you that you can look at and say, I'll go forward if you'll go forward. You know, I'll put my money up if you'll put your money up. You know, I'm willing to do this if you're willing to do it. And I've just found, you know, over the years, and that's, you know, one of the principles that I didn't mention was synergy. That hey, you know, two pulling together can do a whole lot more than the sum of two pulling separately. I mean, it's a geometric progression that begins to happen. And so, you know, I would say one of the things is just surrounding yourself with courageous people, surrounding yourself with other people who aren't afraid. That's why teams are so effective, because if we were just by ourselves, if we were just on our own, you know, whether that is a Maasai warrior out on the plain or us in you know, in a Madison Square, you know, office, you know, it's the same principle, you know, that synergy of having more than one helps you be more objective, you know, with your fears. The other thing is, you know, a lot of times if you take the time to unpack what am I really afraid of here? What is it that I'm really is really giving me pause about this, you know, step that I want to take or this decision that I want to make, and you take the time to really, you know, do the forensics on your fear and do the due diligence on the data that you have. I heard somebody say one time, an objective or an objection is a problem that you don't have a strategy to address. Because once you got a strategy to address it, you know, it's not a problem anymore. You just, oh, okay, I know how to deal with that. And you know, you're sitting around a room and something that might stress you out or you might be afraid of, you look across, you know, the board room table and this guy's totally confident. Why? Because he's got a strategy to address it. You know, and so doing those things, finding fearless people to be around. I mean, the word encourage means to put courage into somebody. And some people encourage you and some people discourage you. And you got to recognize who those people are. And you got to kind of insulate yourself from the people that are constantly discouraging, not who are giving you good, insightful input, but the people that just think you can't do it because they can't do it. And you got to insulate yourself from those folks. Otherwise, you know, they'll take you down.
Absolutely. Eric Wright is the author, co-author, along with Jeff Pearsall. The book, again, is Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars, Your GPS in an Era of Hyperchange. And bottom line is, ladies and gentlemen, do not be a parked car. And it's a fun book. I love the fact that you guys took this theme and ran with it. So each chapter has, you know, a little, what do you call it, play on the theme of the dog. So you have
of a dog and dog characteristics. Yeah.
Yep, and all that stuff. So it's great. Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars. Eric Wright, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing today.
Hey, thank you so much for the opportunity. I have really enjoyed the conversation.
You bet. Anytime. Good stuff there from Eric Wright, co-author of Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars. And I love his enthusiasm. I love his the way he explained things. And I love, really, one of my big takeaways from today is faith and fear are basically the same. I never thought about that. So, Eric, thank you so much. Faith and fear are both based on things that are unseen. Think about that. It blows me away. And I love his stuff there about how do you deal with fear. Well, you got to kind of come up with a strategy for it. And I love his explanation of the duo, right? You have your buddy. You know, when I go scuba diving, I prefer to go scuba diving with a buddy, and they encourage that, right? It's almost, in some places, you're not allowed to go scuba diving by yourself because that's when bad things can happen. So it's good to have a buddy with you. Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars is the name of the book, and I hope you'll go out and check it out. It's at Amazon or wherever good books are sold. We'll also put it here in the show notes. And ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor. Please share this with everyone you know who is wanting to increase their leadership skills, who's an entrepreneur. Maybe they're a mom. Maybe they're a dad, because you don't need to have a fancy title. We're all leaders in our communities, in our homes, in our businesses. Whether or not we own that business, we are a leader in that business. So check out the book, Dogs Don't Bark at Parked Cars. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.